How did Steve Jobs become Steve Jobs? Brad Stone will join us to talk about the new biography by Brent Shendler and Rick Tazzelli, Becoming Steve Jobs.
Ultimately, he was, you know, all about the company. You know, he was all about Apple. That was one of his children. And it was a win-at-all-cost mentality. And when people were less useful to him, he did discard them.
What can three new books tell us about the brain? Amanda Schaefer will be here to talk about her review of three books on neuroscience, The Teenage Brain, The Brain's Way of Healing, and Tales from Both Sides of the Brain.
You know, your brain is not an excuse for this bad behavior, but you should understand that you have these limitations.
Alexandra Alter will share her notes in the publishing world, and Greg Coles has bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. Brad Stone joins us now. He is a senior writer at Bloomberg Businessweek and also author of The Everything Store, Jeff Bezos and the Age of Amazon. This week, he reviews the new book about Steve Jobs, Becoming Steve Jobs, The Evolution of a Reckless Upstart into a Visionary Leader by Brent Shendler and Rick Tazzelli. Hi, Brad.
Hi, Pamela.
So I think the first question that people are going to ask is when they think, look at this book, like, I thought there already was a book about Steve Jobs.
That's right. And not just Walter Isaacson's massive bestseller, Steve Jobs, but you could fill a library right now with all the Apple books. You know, you have recently Haunted Empire, Apple After Steve Jobs by Yukari Kane, which I also reviewed for the book review. There are books on Johnny Ive. There are books about, you know, Apple's presentation secrets. There's The Internal Culture of Apple, a book by Adam Leshinsky a few years ago. Apple versus Google. I mean, it goes on and on. But you're right. I mean, Walter Isaacson has the big one. Everything else orbits around his book. But the funny thing is, even though everybody bought that book and the timing, you know, was, you know, tragically good because it came out right after Jobs' death, it turns out that Apple itself didn't like it, kind of mysteriously so. When Brent and Rick then came along with this other account, a lot of the insiders got behind it as an alternative to what Walter had presented. So it ends up actually serving as an interesting juxtaposition.
What didn't they like about Walter Isaacson's book?
I mean, it's kind of mystifying to me. They present it as having a one-sided view of Steve as being, you know, a kind of immature leader, as being someone who is dominated by his passions, by his competitiveness. That was certainly true. The argument in Becoming Steve Jobs by Brent and Rick is that that was less true over time, that Steve really matured as a leader. You know, I just find the critique of Walter's book to be a little unfair. As I say in this review, look, Steve cooperated with Walter. Walter Isaacson had the best access of anyone. And he also, you know, was operating under a pretty incredible time constraint. But I found, you know, my recollection of not reading it 2 years ago was that Walter did also present a complete picture. And that Becoming Steve Jobs, this new book, is sort of less revisionist than it thinks it is. But that said, it's still a pretty good work in addition to this catalog.
Well, if we're going to talk about access, certainly the lead author of this book, Brent Shendler, had plenty of access. I think you say that he watched Toy Story with Jobs's kids at Jobs's house.
I know. Can you imagine? I mean, what a momentous experience. This book says something interesting about the technology media of which, you know, I am a part, and about the way Apple manipulated it. And Jobs was the master of it. He played this really long game where he rewarded, you know, the most sort of faithful correspondents who hewed the closest to the Apple line. And Brent was great at that, you know. And there's something to be said for it. You know, among the group of reporters in the 80s and 90s that, well, really in the 80s, who got the closest to Steve Jobs, and that's a group that includes my former colleague Stephen Levy, who wrote many great Apple books, John Markoff of the New York Times, my colleague now at Bloomberg, Peter Burroughs. I mean, Brent was right up there. You know, perhaps no one talked to Steve as much, and you know, Steve's enemies didn't like Brent, and Steve did, and that turned into a lot of great Fortune cover stories, and now this book. So yeah, Brent Shendler had this very long and actually quite moving history with Steve, which ended when Brent himself got sick Ended up in Stanford Hospital for many months, struggling with an infection he had picked up in South America. And Steve actually visited him in the hospital and helped with his care. So, kind of running through this book is this interesting backstory that also tells us a lot about how the technology media covers these giants.
I think you mentioned that Schindler was hallucinatory, and Jobs went so far as to kind of tell the hospital that this guy deserved VIP treatment. And yet, as you note, he kind of broke things off with Schindler once he left Fortune, right?
That's right. It was sort of interesting that Brent seemed kind of, he writes in the book that he was sort of mystified by it and didn't understand it and was kind of hurt by it. And this was, back in about 2005. And as a result, kind of was resentful. And even when Steve died, didn't fully attend all the memorial services because he was resentful about it. And yet, from an outsider reading, the subtext is kind of clear, which is that, Steve was, he did care for the people around him. He took a personal interest in the lives of his top executives. There's a lot of interesting stuff here about his relationship with Tim Cook. And yet, ultimately, he was, all about the company. He was all about Apple. That was one of his children. And it was a win-at-all-cost mentality. And when people were less useful to him, he did discard them. It happened with Apple executives, and it happened with journalists.
With Schindler, who, as you mentioned, was a longtime writer for Fortune, and before that for the Wall Street Journal, and his co-author, Tetzeli, who is at Fast Company, that you mentioned that one of the things they do get that Isaacson didn't have was access to some other key Apple figures and people from Jobs' life. Who did they talk to?
Tim Cook, who, I think did talk to Walter Isaacson, but Keir talks more at length, who clearly has a little bit of a chip on his shoulder about Walter Isaacson's book. He even addresses it straightforwardly in the book, saying it presented a one-sided view. There are other Apple executives, Johnny Ive, another top executive. And then the Disney leadership, Bob Iger, John Lasseter, Ed Catmull Dull at Pixar. Those stories I found actually the most moving in the book. The whole chapter about Disney's acquisition of Pixar and how Bob Iger and Steve Jobs kind of struck up this relationship, how Steve told Bob Iger up that his cancer was back and offered him a way out of the acquisition, and then how their partnership and their friendship grew. It was really fresh, moving stuff. There is some stuff from Steve's wife, but she's very private, and I didn't find that the most compelling. But it was really the Apple and the Disney insiders who, for whatever reason, felt that there was more of the story to tell and that Walter Isaacson hadn't covered it.
Also, a moving story between with him and Tim Cook when Jobs got sick again that you retell in your review.
That's right. One of the things that, jumped out at me and a lot of other readers right off the bat was this story in 2009 where Steve is ailing and he is on this perpetual waiting list for liver transplants in California. And Tim actually goes to research this idea of giving part of his own liver to Steve. And this idea that, it's called a living donor transplant and that you can donate a portion of your liver and then both will grow to a functional size. And Steve and Tim relays making that offer to a bedridden Jobs and Jobs really getting angry at him in one of the very few times and saying, that I will never let you do that, being somehow offended at the offer. There was another story of them in the very last year days of Steve's life watching a movie at his house, Remember the Titans, this great football comeback movie, which kind of mirrors the Apple comeback story.
Right.
And, and a couple other stories like that. I mean, I find a lot of the book to be a little repetitive. If you have, like I have, read a lot of Apple books, you're familiar with some of it. But it's in these later chapters where you start hearing from Tim Cook where it really delivers.
So, okay, let's imagine the busy non-Apple obsessive who asks herself, which book, I want to just read one book about, Steve Jobs, which should it be? What advice would you give?
Well, this isn't a bad option. I mean, it's a shorter read. Walter Isaacson's book is far more comprehensive. Walter goes into far more depth about Apple's early or Steve's early years. Reed College, the Atari years. I mean, if you really want the full story, that's probably still the definitive account. Becoming Steve Jobs kind of picks its spots more. It concentrates to a large extent on the middle years where Steve was at Next. He had been banished from Apple, and then the last years of his life. I think, you know, Walter Isaacson's book is still the definitive account. Now, if you really want the cliff notes, just hang on, because there's a movie coming out this year, right?
With Michael Fassbender, no less.
That's right, Michael. Thank you. I was going to totally forget his name. So, you know, you kind of have a full spectrum of ways to go here if you want to do your homework on Steve Jobs.
All right. I have to ask you one last question, since you did write a book about Jeff Bezos and Amazon, and pun unintended, I know they're apples and oranges, but these tech entrepreneurs loom large. Are there any interesting parallels and comparisons that you would make between Jobs and Bezos?
There's so many comparisons, favorable, interesting juxtapositions, ways that they're different. Adam Leshinsky in A Fortune Story once said it best, where he said, you know, one of the great tragedies of Jobs' early death is that we didn't get to see Steve and Jeff like battle like gladiators, you know, for the rest of their careers. And there's, you know, things that are similar, like how devoted they were to their companies, how visionary they were, how they really placed bets, went all in on products and categories when other people might have held back. But then the differences are just as stark. You know, Steve, you know, he bet on a couple of products, a very limited selection. They were fully realized, beautifully designed. You know, they kind of, you know, complete the stack of services from hardware to software. And you can count them on, you know, one hand in terms of, you know, the Apple iconic products. Whereas Bezos is building Amazon very differently. I mean, you know, you look at some of the websites and the products, you know, and they scream the design sensibility of 1992. So it's like a different aesthetic. But then Bezos is sort of assembling this empire so strategically, bit by bit, where you'd have to like fill a whiteboard, you know, to kind of understand how it works with Amazon Prime and the Kindle tablets and everything reinforcing each other. So different in the way they run their companies, but also, you know, so similar in how visionary they are, determined, kind of relentless, sometimes difficult to work with. Obviously two great figures in business history.
Well, I think you just came up with a great video game idea there with that gladiator fight. Brad Stone, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Pamela.
Brad Stone is a senior writer at Bloomberg Businessweek, the author of The Everything Store, Jeff Bezos and the Age of Amazon, and he reviews in the book review this week the new biography, Becoming Steve Jobs, by Brent Shendler and Rick Tazzelli. Alexander Alter is here with Notes from the Publishing World. Hi, Alexandra.
Hi, Pamela.
All right. What are we talking about today?
So there's an interesting kind of throwback trend that I've noticed. You would think in this age of really short attention spans, when people get their news from Twitter and watch 6-second videos on Vine, that big books would sort of be on their way out. But a handful of authors are still writing really long. I'm talking like 1,500 to 3,000 pages.
Undaunted. Well, you know what? The problem is maybe they started them long before attention span
right.
thing happened.
I think that's exactly what happened. So the first one that's coming out next is Larry Kramer's novel. Larry Kramer, the playwright, has been working on this book for more than 40 years. It's a 2-volume history of the American people, but it's actually fiction. And originally the manuscript was 4,000 pages, but FSG got him to cut it a bit. The first volume comes out next week. It's 800 pages long. It's a history of homosexuality in America and of the AIDS virus, and it goes back to prehistoric times in the Everglades.
A fictionalized history, we should say.
A fictionalized history with actual history mixed in. It's kind of an interesting form. He said that I spoke to him this week, and he said that, you know, he didn't want to call it a novel. He sees this as actual history, and he feels like everything is true, even the stuff that he fictionalized is getting at some kind of essential truth. But
okay, let's talk about Lincoln.
Yes, Lincoln, gay.
All right.
Yes. And Washington and Walt Whitman and a number of other figures. Anyway, it's a fascinating but incredibly challenging book. It's not exactly light reading. So I had barely recovered from reading that book when I got an enormous package from Viking. It looked like it had 3 or 4 galleys in it. I opened it up. It's William Volman's next novel, which is coming out in July, and that's 1,356 pages long.
We actually stacked it up next to 2 other immense novels slated for this spring, and it was the same height as
these two combined. See, exactly. It's about twice. It's like reading The Goldfinch twice. You know, it's incredibly long. It's set in the American West in the 1870s, has flashbacks to the Civil War, and it centers on this American general's pursuit of a Native American chief. And, you know, Volman is famously averse to cutting anything. And he's said in interviews before that when his publisher has asked him to cut parts of previous books to save paper, he's compromised by cutting his royalties instead. So that was for an 832-page book, and I can't imagine how much he's might have to cut his royalties for a book that's almost 1,400 pages.
He also just had a not insubstantial collection of short stories come out recently.
He's incredibly prolific.
Okay.
And this is, I think this novel, I believe, is part of a suite of 7 books that are sort of thematically connected.
Are we going up in page count?
We are. We're going up in page count. So the biggest one that I've heard of lately is coming next year, and it's by Alan Moore, who's best known for his graphic novels Watchmen and V. And this is his 2nd non-graphic novel, and it's called...
Oh, I was going to say at least there are pictures.
No pictures, all text. The title is Jerusalem. It's coming out in 2016. And in interviews, Mr. Moore has said that this book is about 1 million words long. That's probably close to 3,000 pages. He's been working on it for more than 20 years, according to Publishers Weekly. And it takes place in his hometown in England and tackles all kinds of subjects, including the nature of time and mortality, and has actual historical figures sprinkled throughout. And at a book of that length, you can imagine they span all kinds of eras. There's Oliver Cromwell, there's Buffalo Bill, there's James Joyce's daughter. So 3,000 pages, cut out, you know, book it a couple months next year to set aside to read this book.
Okay. I'm sure you'll be the first to get started. Thanks, Alexandra.
Thanks for having me.
Amanda Schaefer is here to talk about her shortlist review of 3 new books about neuroscience. Hi, Amanda.
Hi, Pamela.
So the 3 books, I'm just going to go down the titles and authors, and then we can talk about them one by one. First book, The Teenage Brain, A Neuroscientist's Survival Guide to Raising Adolescents and Young Adults by Frances Jensen and Amy Ellis Nutt. Then, The Brain's Way of Healing by Norman Doidge, Remarkable Discoveries and Recoveries from the Frontiers of Neuroplasticity. And finally, Michael Gazzaniga's book, Tales from Both Sides of the Brain, A Life in Neuroscience. All right, let's start with The Teenage Brain. There was a big story recently in the New York Times Magazine by Rachel Cusk about just the trials of raising a teenager that really resonated with readers. What do we learn about the teenage brain from this book?
Well, Frances Jensen and Amy Ellis Nutt really are trying to take head on how it is that a child can seem to turn almost overnight into a sullen, moody, explosive, risk-taking teenager. And they really want to look at both sides of the coin, how the teenage brain is both more powerful and more vulnerable than the adult brain. So they get into the nitty-gritty of the neuroscience. They talk very much about how teenage brains are extremely plastic. So teenagers are really primed to learn. They form memories more readily than adults do. Their memories also seem to persist for longer. So that can be a boon in terms of learning and growing intellectually. It can also mean that they're primed to learn the wrong things if they are around.
Just when you were getting excited and feeling better about things, we hear the downside.
Right. Also, their brains are not fully insulated or myelinated. So significant areas, especially in their frontal lobes, have yet to be, as they describe it, fully wired up with the rest of the brain.
What does myelination mean exactly?
Myelination is a coating around the axons of some neurons. And basically what it does is it makes the electrical signaling more efficient. So one of the examples that they give, they point out that the frontal cortex, which is responsible for judgment and decision making, is not fully myelinated. myelinated until later. And so what that can mean is that the sort of impulsive or risk-taking impulses that may emanate from other parts of the brain may have trouble sort of linking up with the judgment and decision centers, all of which can mean that teenagers may find themselves in dangerous situations, not quite knowing what to do about it.
But they can blame it on biology.
Well, she does engage directly with that. I mean, she talks about introducing these brain concepts directly to teens and telling them that, you know, your brain is not an excuse for this bad behavior, but you should understand that you have these limitations. She definitely makes that part of the parenting strategies that she recommends.
Would you give this book to a teenager and say, like, hey, read this and you'll understand better what's going on with you? Or is this a book for parents? Who's this for?
I think the authors might advocate giving the actual book to teens. Jensen has a story in which she's trying to convince her sons not to multitask while they're doing their homework. She sees them watching TV and answering email and texting and trying to study for exams at the same time. And her approach is to pull out a scientific study and show them a graph of what happens to college students who are trying to do a word recall task at the same time as they're being distracted. And she sort of demonstrates with this graph that they can't multitask as effectively as they probably think they can. And apparently with her sons, that's completely successful, and they close their email and hit the books. I mean, I think it's worth saying that one of her sons is now a business consultant. The other one went on to get a degree in quantum physics. So they were probably susceptible to this sort of information-driven approach to parenting.
Right. Is this a parenting book? Is it a neuroscience book? Is it a hybrid?
I would call it a hybrid. There's a lot of great information about the neurobiology of the teenage brain for people who want to dig into information about myelination or the reward circuitry and the way that teenagers respond to dopamine. There are riches in here for readers of that kind. But Jensen and Nutt also offer quite a bit of practical advice. And they have a very protective view of teenagers in light of these limitations with the teenage brain. They really say that parents need to be the teen's frontal lobes, you know. So that means taking the book bag, dumping it out, helping the teenager organize the homework. So it's an interesting combination because they're both very respectful of teenagers' thirst for information and respectful of teenagers' needs to take risks and explore and develop autonomy, but also have this slight helicoptery flavor in some of their advice.
If you were to have one of these teenage creatures in your household one day, is there something from this book that you would take and really apply?
I like the idea of showing or explaining how the brain works. I agree with the idea that teenagers and people in general are naturally curious about themselves and their biology. And I always think that bringing in, you know, if you can turn someone's difficult behavior into a teachable moment and maybe get some good behavior out of it, why not?
And then finally, looking back at your own adolescence, reading this book, was there anything that you thought that, you know, gave you insight into your own past, your own teenage years?
I think the book would be interesting for people who want to reflect on their own teenage years. I mean, I think it's interesting because when thinking about one's own life, it's less appealing to reduce great experiences to sort of heightened neurochemistry. I find myself resistant to that prospect. But I think it is true, you know, especially what they talk about in terms of reward circuitry and the way teens respond in such a heightened way to dopamine. This idea that you can experience great exuberance and great excitement and be open to new experiences. And I'm not going to get more personal than
that. Okay. Well, at least we know why things were so much fun when you're a teenager. Let's talk about Norman Doidge's new book, The Brain's Way of Healing. His first book, The Brain That Changes Itself, was a massive bestseller. Is this an expansion of that, a continuation? How is this different?
It's very much a continuation. I mean, he has become a real celebrity doctor who's traveled, spoken about this research. He even follows up with some patients in this book. But the focus of the new book, The Brain's Way of Healing, is really looking at how the brain's capacity for reorganizing and rewiring can be used potentially in service of patients with chronic pain, Parkinson's disease, traumatic brain injury, multiple sclerosis.
This book, I think, is structured primarily around some major case studies. Is that correct?
Yes.
So he's sort of telling the stories. This person was suffering from X or had this injury, and here's how this person was healed or improved.
Exactly.
And that was a way the brain that changes itself was also structured. Are these updated stories? Are they new ones? Are they just?
It's a combination. I mean, it's been a number of years since the last book mm-hmm. came out, and there have been new developments. And he focuses more on treatment modalities. For instance, he talks a lot about research being conducted in Madison, Wisconsin, on a neuromodulatory device. And some of that work is new. I mean, it has come out since the last book. He tells the story, for instance, of a professional singer named Ron who, through multiple sclerosis, lost the ability to walk or sing or swallow and goes and tries this neuromodulatory device, which is a device that it resembles, according to Deutsch, it resembles a wide stick of chewing gum that sits on the tongue and has electrodes on the underside. And so it sends electrical impulses into the tongue, and from there they travel to the brain. And the idea is that this can modulate the brain's behavior.
I found that, you know, reading Deutsch's first book, that you come away with this sense of, wow, you know, neuroplasticity is incredible. The brain can do anything. You could, you know, have a terrible injury and the brain can recover, particularly early in life. But one of your criticisms of this book is that he overpromises a little bit or focuses a little bit heavily on the success.
Yes. I mean, he focuses almost exclusively on spectacular success stories. And they're inspiring. I think he is intending the book and his last book to be inspirational, motivating for patients. And I certainly don't want to dismiss that impulse in any way. I think there is a lot of inspiration in this book. My caution is more that the stories that he's featuring are not necessarily representative of the scientific literature as a whole. You know, for instance, with this tongue stimulatory device, the professional singer that he features, you know, after a week in the lab with this device, this man who had lost his voice completely was belting out show tunes for the lab. And, you know, after the course of his treatment, he was tap dancing, you know, having walked in originally mm-hmm. with a cane. And then these researchers, I mean, their work is terrifically interesting, and they did in 2014 publish a small randomized controlled trial of their work. And they found that in patients with MS, they looked at 10 patients treated with this device and found that in undergoing work with the device combined with exercise, these patients did have modest improvements in their gait. And so that's sort of the disconnect. It's not that there can't be improvement, but the stories that he chooses just may not be representative of the kinds of gains that patients may have. And when you're talking about early science and emergent technology, there's always the question of what will happen as devices or promising therapies go through clinical trials. And that really has yet to be seen for most of what he's talking about.
All right, let's turn to the third book by Michael Gazzanaga, Tales from Both Sides of the Brain, A Life in Neuroscience. I have to say, we all know you can't read too much into blurbs, but for a book by a major pioneer in neuroscience, it's interesting to note that on the back we have blurbs from Tom Wolfe, Conan O'Brien, and Alan Alda. I don't know if you can explain that, but who is Gazzanaga?
So he is a luminary in the field of neuroscience. He's considered a founder of cognitive neuroscience, which is the study of how the brain creates the mind. And he's lived a wonderful, rich life that he describes in a lot of detail in the book.
Is it a memoir to a certain extent?
Yes, it very much is. He focuses both on his scientific work and on his intellectual and social life. He's been close friends for many years, for instance, with William F. Buckley Jr., spent a lot of time with the National Review crowd.
So you are going to answer how he knows all these guys.
It makes a lot of sense that he would know all of those people and more.
Tell us a little bit about his background, where he grew up, how he became a neuroscientist.
Well, he attended Dartmouth. And again, you know, in terms of his lively life at Dartmouth, he was in the fraternity that's featured in Animal House. So he has this partying past. He then went to Caltech for graduate school, and it was there that he did the experiments that really started to make his name.
What is he well known for?
So the work that he did at Caltech involved early studies on patients who had undergone a surgery to disconnect the fibers between the right and left hemispheres of their brain. And this was a surgery that was performed for patients with severe cases of epilepsy who hadn't responded to many other treatments. And so it was an extreme measure. But he had the remarkable opportunity to study what the potential cognitive changes were as a result of this surgery. So he describes in the book being a graduate student sitting with this patient named W.J., who had just undergone this procedure. And what he did was he flashed a square so that it could be seen by W.J.'s right hemisphere. What he discovered was that the left hemisphere of W.J.'s brain was completely in the dark, again, because these fibers had been severed. And the left hemisphere in patients like W.J. is responsible for language. And so when he asked him what he had seen, W.J. said he saw nothing. And this was sort of one of those astonishing moments in the history of science. Gazzaniga describes feeling himself sweat, his heart racing, realizing that he was confronting the question of whether our skulls actually house two separate minds.
And what was the answer to that question?
Well, in that sense, yes. You know, this was an example of the right and the left hemispheres acting independently. And that's a theme that he's pursued doggedly throughout his career. He's looked at different ways in which the right and left sides of the brain both act independently and cue each other. But updating the story, I think many scientists, including Gazzaniga, would now say that actually it's not just a matter of right and left. Our brains actually operate as sort of a confederation of multiple processors, all sort of aggregated within our minds that we really – Gazzaniga is also well known for a comment he made a few years ago that our brains work more by local gossip than by central planning.
That's an interesting metaphor. Recently, there have been surgeries where you can remove half the brain, right? You can remove one half of the brain, a hemispherectomy. The other half will accommodate or make up for those changes. Does he talk about that in his book at all?
He doesn't. That seems like it might be more the purview, actually, of Norman Doidge talking about how the brain can accommodate and respond to some extent, you know, after very traumatic events or large-scale surgeries. Interestingly, you know, while we're speaking of plasticity and Gazzaniga, he was a nice counterpoint to Doidge. He wasn't, of course, responding to him directly, but since I had both of their voices in my head, I felt that one might be sort of talking to the other in my mind. But Gazzaniga is cautionary about excessive claims of neuroplasticity. His perspective, which is a little bit more of a downer than Doidge's, is that most neurologic disease has a sort of deadening finality to it. And he says that slack is not automatically taken up by another part of the brain, mm-hmm. and that we sort of overestimate how much the brain can change.
Does that apply only to disease or also to injury?
In this particular quote, he uses the word disease, but my guess from the context is that he would apply it to injury. The truth clearly lies somewhere in the middle. You know, Gazzaniga, I think, is responding to some of the excessive claims that mm-hmm. have been made on behalf of brain plasticity, but this certainly doesn't diminish the fact that it's a real phenomenon and the brain can change to a large extent.
The book is titled Tales from Both Sides of the Brain. Is it told largely in stories from his experience? And was there one that stood out for you as particularly interesting?
Well, the book really is founded on this early scientific discovery. But he's a storyteller. I mean, he's a luminary late in his career. He's known many interesting people, and he does have wonderful stories to tell. He talks a lot about travels that he did with his lab team throughout New England, visiting the homes of these split brain patients. He outfitted a trailer so that he could have this mobile lab unit, and they'd go on these epic road trips and bring the patients into their trailer. But he really seems like someone who has enjoyed life. He also talks about how his wife was along and cooked four-course dinners for everyone. At the same time as they were doing hours and hours of psychological testing with the patients.
These three books are obviously quite different. I'm just going to run through the titles again. The Teenage Brain, A Neuroscientist's Survival Guide to Raising Adolescents and Young Adults by Frances Jensen and Amy Ellis Nutt. Norman Doidge's new book, The Brain's Way of Healing, Remarkable Discoveries and Recoveries from the Frontiers of Neuroplasticity. And finally, Michael Gazzaniga's Tales from Both Sides of the Brain. So very different books, but the benefit, I think, probably of reading them all together and reviewing them is sort of seeing what's going on in neuroscience as a whole. Was there something in one of the books in particular that you took away as being especially interesting or informative? Just something that kind of stood out for you?
It's exciting to hear the reflections of someone like Gazzaniga at this stage in his career. You know, he's come through so many years of research, and to see what's on his mind at this moment was particularly interesting for me. The idea that he thinks a lot about the brain as this confederation of modules, and really grapples with the question of how, with this decentralization in our brains, we can somehow appear so seamless to ourselves that mm-hmm. we can seem to have this particular psychological signature, that he really regards that as one of the big questions going forward. And that stuck with me. I mean, I think these are the kinds of questions that neuroscience can provoke. These are huge questions about who we are, why we do what we do, why we think what we think, why we buy what we buy. And it's interesting to come at them from these different perspectives.
People like to read about themselves. Amanda, thank you so much.
Thank you, Pamela.
Amanda Schaefer is a contributing editor at the MIT Technology Review and a former science and medical columnist for Slate. And this week, she writes the shortlist on three new books about neuroscience. Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
What's new?
Not a lot. There are two new titles on the hardcover fiction list. Down at number 8, Randy Wayne White continues his Doc Ford series. These are kind of mystery thrillers set in the Sanibel Island region of Florida. The latest one is called Cuba Straits, Straits, and it is new at number 8. Then at number 2, Harlan Coben is back with a standalone thriller called The Stranger, and that makes its debut up at number 2.
Okay. Nonfiction?
also not a lot, just two new titles on the nonfiction side of things, too. Again, at number 8, Ayaan Hirsi Ali has a new book called Heretic. It's less a memoir than her book Infidel, which spent a long time on our bestseller list back in 2007 and 8 and 9.
And then she had Nomad, her second
right,
memoir.
Right, which also had a lot of memoiristic elements in it. Heretic is more of a kind of manifesto. It's really a call for an Islamic reformation, a call for secularizing and modernizing the religion of Islam. She's really kind of joined the new atheists, only instead of taking on Christianity, she's taking on Islam.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've seen a lot of support for her online by people like Sam Harris, for example, Richard Dawkins. She's such an interesting figure. I profiled her back in 2010.
It's interesting, too. I write about her in the column this week. Her whole message is really about liberalizing Islam, and she considers herself a liberal, a feminist, a liberal. She really excoriates Islam for its treatment of women and its treatment of gays and non-believers, and she wants to bring it into the modern age. She's got a very progressive message, and yet she feels spurned by liberals in America. She has really been embraced much more by the conservative community. And in fact, when she was looking to work at think tanks once she moved to America from the Netherlands back in 2007, she couldn't find a job at any of the liberal think tanks, and the American Enterprise Institute ended up taking her on.
Clearly an independent thinker, even if she is affiliated with that particular think tank. And Susan Dominus reviews her this week in the Book Review.
Yes, she does.
What else?
And then finally, also again at number two. So both new titles on fiction and nonfiction this week are at number eight and number two. Number two on the nonfiction list is the new Steve Jobs biography, Becoming Steve Jobs, by Brent Schlender and Rick Tetzeli.
And obviously, we just talked to Brad Stone earlier about that book.
Who reviewed it for us, yes.
Okay, thanks, Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For The New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.